You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Welcome to the Carnegie Endowment, and welcome to our event on previewing Egypt's upcoming elections. I'm Michelle Dunn. I'm a scholar in the Middle East program here at Carnegie, and we have today two exceptional speakers. We have my colleague from our Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut, Dr. Amer Hamzawi, and we have another colleague of mine, Jeremy Sharp from the Congressional Research Service. These are two people who are extremely well-informed about what is going on in Egypt, and I think we're going to have a fascinating discussion today. Before we begin, I want to make one more introduction, which is that as of today, Carnegie has a visiting scholar from the Middle East for the summer. If you would stand up, please. This is Tagrid Al-Khodari. She has been the New York Times correspondent in Gaza, lo these many years, and has agreed to come out and spend a few months at Carnegie, so she will be here in the Middle East program working on Palestinian affairs, and we're very delighted to have her with us, and we're doing that in partnership with the Heinrich Böll Foundation. So now back to today's events. We are going to be talking about this very interesting political season in Egypt that we see beginning now and going over the next few months. I'm sorry, over the next more than a year, many months, not few months. And as I said, our two speakers, our main speaker is Dr. Amer Hamzawi, my colleague at the Carnegie Middle East Center. He's a noted Egyptian political scientist. He's on the faculty at Cairo University and formerly of the Free University in Berlin. He's a regular columnist in Ashuruq newspaper in Egypt, and a frequent participant in media debates in Egypt and elsewhere in the Arab world. And he's going to share with us his insights of what is going on in Egypt now. And then we're going to have as discussant Jeremy Sharp from the Congressional Research Service. Jeremy is very much an expert on Egypt and on U.S. policy toward the region. He's the author of several congressional reports on U.S. relations with Egypt and with other Arab countries, as well as U.S. foreign aid to the Middle East. And Jeremy will be speaking in his personal capacity and not as a representative of CRS or the U.S. government today. Okay, so we're going to get started now. It's very interesting. As Amer and I were chatting informally this morning, we were kind of comparing the political scene in Egypt to now to what was going on in at this time in 2005, 5 years ago when Egypt last held elections. Presidential and parliamentary elections were held in the same year in 2005. This year we have parliamentary elections this year and a presidential election next year, or possibly before that, should the succession happen before that. And I think it's very interesting to kind of contrast this. Once again, we see in Egypt kind of an opposition. We see the opposition becoming a bit enlivened in the period leading up to elections. And so Amer's going to share with us his thoughts about that. You're going to speak for about 20 minutes, Amer, right? And then we'll have comments from Jeremy. And then we're going to leave lots of time for your questions and discussion.
Okay. Thank you very much, Michelle. It's a pleasure to be here. In a way, it's a pleasure to be back. Let me start by basically building on what Michelle just said, comparing Egyptian politics 2010, probably 2011, to what the situation was in 2004 and 2005. There are some similarities which we need to be aware of. In 2004 and 2005, the Egyptian opposition spectrum primarily informal opposition networks, not conventional political parties, were getting active lobbying basically on two sets of demands: A, constitutional amendments, and B, in relation to the presidential succession, lobbying against President Mubarak's fifth term, or the possibility, even in 2005, possibility of President Mubarak's son, Gamal Mubarak, taking over. if you compare the platform of informal opposition in 2004 and 2005 to the current platform of the National Association or Movement for Change formed by Muhammad al-Baradi and by different informal political actors and groups, be it the Muslim Brotherhood or otherwise, the platform is quite similar. In fact, the platform in 2010, probably in 2011, is structured around the two sets of demands, constitutional amendments and issues related to the presidential succession. As of now, the Egyptian opposition is pushing for a change of Article 76, 77, 88 of the Constitution. I'm going to go back to those articles and what they say. And they are lobbying against a new term, a six, if possible, for if it's going to happen, of President Mubarak, and against a succession by President Mubarak's son, Gamal Mubarak. So we have a similarity in terms of platform. And in a way, this means that not much has changed in Egypt between 2004 and 2005 and 2010-2011. Second point, the composition of the opposition spectrum which we are looking at is very similar to 2004 and 2005. In 2004 and 2005, the dynamism of the opposition was headed by informal networks. Kifaya was a big name in 2004 and 2005, and primarily activists of different generations that seemed to be able to cross the ideological divide between Islamist and non-Islamist opposition. In 2010 and 2011, we are still looking very much at the same composition. We have a replacement. Kifaya is now not the leading actor. Kifaya has become a part, a component of the national movement for change headed by Dr. al-Baradi, but the movement itself, the national movement of al-Baradi, is very much structured around the same principle of loose alliance, cross-ideological lobbying around a platform. The third similarity between 2004, 2005, and 2010, 2011 is the fact that while the opposition is putting forward, or did put forward in 04 and 05, or is putting forward in 2010, 2011, a platform, a maximalist platform calling for constitutional amendments, for a full democratization of Egypt, and putting that platform forward, the opposition was not able in 04 and 05, and is still not able in 2010, 2011, to translate that platform into a set of concrete actions, an action plan of sorts. Up until now, we do not know whether the movement centered around Dr. al-Baradi will be able to, or is interested in, fielding candidates in the parliamentary elections, Shura Council elections and People's Assembly elections, upper chamber and lower chamber of the Egyptian parliament in 2010. What are they going to do if the government continues to boycott and reject the demands to amend the constitution to allow for independence, such as Dr. al-Baradi to run on the presidential ballot in 2011. We do not know how they are trying to hold the government to hold the government accountable. So we have a maximalist platform calling for constitutional amendments, addressing the issue of the presidency, and it's not being translated into a concrete set of actions. This was the case in 04 and 05, and this is the case in 2010 and 2011. There is one central difference between, and one significant difference between 04, 05 and 2010, 2011, and this is the Baradi factor, I would say. In 2004 and 2005, the opposition did not have a candidate around whom everyone rallied and mobilized and identified the movement, the drive for change with that person. Now it is a different situation. In 04 and 05, we had Kifaya, we had a bit of Ayman Noor, we had a bit of Al-Wafd, Nu'man Gom'a, but this, no one of them was a unified opposition candidate. As of now, al-Baradi represents the clear and accepted opposition candidate, and he brings in assets internationally and domestically that need to be looked at. He brings in internationally the asset of being a recognized personality. Domestically, he is not a corrupt politician. And as you know, Egyptian politics, Egyptian political space has never been an innocent space, and in a way, opposition and government activists, politicians, have been implicated in different corruption allegations. I'm referring to Ayman Noor's, to the allegations which was fielded by the regime against Ayman Noor approaching the elections of 2005 and right after it. Dr. al-Baradi is different. He has not been part of the domestic game. He cannot be accused of being corrupt. So he brings in international recognition. He brings in fresh energy and being away from the corrupt domestic political space which we are looking at. There's one deficit which the government is trying to highlight in relation to Bradley, namely the fact that he has been out of the country for a long time. But he has been managing that quite well. We can get into that later. But sort of we have a couple of similarities, and we have an interesting difference related to Dr. El-Baradei's role. Let me remind you as well of the fact that a year ago, or less than a year ago, Egyptian politics, Egyptian political dynamics did not appear to be as interesting as they are as of now. I mean, if you recall our earlier discussions and even papers which were produced here at Carnegie and elsewhere, looking at Egyptian politics post-2005, and after the regime managed to contain sort of the big injection of the Muslim Brotherhood's role in parliament with the 88 seats they have, Egyptian politics, Egyptian political dynamics were looked at as being in a stalemate, sort of stagnant of sorts. Former politics in Egypt was being described as a stagnant space. If you compare what we used to write and say about Egyptian politics a year ago with what is happening right now, you see a big difference. It's once again becoming more dynamic, and it's creating and generating more interest domestically and internationally. That is not only related to the political calendar and the fact that we are, as Michel mentioned, we are well into a political calendar that is quite intense, but once again, the fact that Al-Baradei and his role has re-energized public, intellectual, and political debates in Egypt. Now, let me, basically, in a couple of minutes, try to review the legal and constitutional environment based on which the parliamentary elections, Shura Council elections, People Assembly elections, as well as the presidential elections are going to take place. Let me start by Article 88 of the Egyptian Constitution, which was amended in 2007 and which basically removed judicial supervision of elections. And this is a key component to look at when we look at the constitution and legal environment. Egyptian elections in 2010 and 2011 will not be supervised by the judiciary. And this has been the case, or was the case in Egypt throughout the 1990s and up until the elections of 2005, parliamentary and presidential. Second interesting component or feature of the legal environment is the fact that the state of emergency, emergency laws, still exist and are going to be renewed. There are increased signs recently that the government is going to introduce the renewal of the emergency law very soon to the People's Assembly. President Mubarak, in his only speech, address to Egyptians since his operation and his sick leave, a couple of weeks ago, the only address, which was a few days ago, he addressed the issue of terrorism, the fact that Egypt still needs a way to tackle the challenge of terrorism, which was interpreted, and Gamal Mubarak came a couple of days later and did agree and went in the same direction. There are signs that the state of emergency is going to be renewed very soon. And the state of emergency means approaching the elections basically two sets of restrictions. One, that political actors, political parties, formal, informal, conventional, less conventional networks or parties cannot rally. They cannot organize a rally anywhere. The security apparatus can arrest them. The security apparatus can harass opposition activists. In fact, today, a few hours ago, there was an attempted march by different MPs, members of parliaments, as well as opposition candidates, to address the demand to change, to amend the constitution to the Speaker of the People's Assembly, Dr. Fathi Sroor, and the march was hindered by the security apparatus, by the security forces. So as long as we have the state of emergency, it's very difficult for any opposition actor to rally and mobilize. Secondly, the state of emergency means that opposition activists, politicians, leaders can be easily harassed. Of course, the Muslim Brotherhood has been the prime target of the regime, but this can be extended to any set of opposition actors, and we have been seeing some of that in the last weeks in relation to Dr. Baradei's National Movement for Change, arrest of some of the activists on April 6, 2010. Third feature of the legal and constitutional environment which we are looking at is the fact that the restrictions and limitations on forming political parties continue to exist. Not much has happened. Fourth feature, and here I move from parliamentary elections to presidential elections, Article 76. As you know, Article 76, which was amended twice in 2005 and 2007, in its current text, Article 76 in reality rules out the possibility of any independent running for the presidential elections. It enables party candidates from the NDP as well, ruling National Democratic Party, as well as from opposition candidates to run, but it in reality rules out the possibility of an independent running, which is a restriction, and the restriction that Al-Baradi and anyone else who is interested and not organized in a political party, not a leader of a political party, will face approaching 2011. In fact, I have to say that there are no signs that the government is willing to amend Article 76 prior to the elections of 2011. Demands by the opposition were rejected by the government systematically in the last weeks. Then we have Article 77. Which does not set term limits for the presidency. This has been a demand in Egypt since 2005. It's a renewed demand since 2005, and the government, in spite of the fact that the constitution was amended twice, 2005 and 2007, has always rejected any amendment that would set a term limit for the Egyptian presidency. So if you look at the constitution and legal environment, it still shows great similarity to 2004 and 2005, in spite of the amendments, 05 and 07, still as restricted as it was with regard to parliamentary elections and with regard to presidential elections. Let me now move into looking at the different actors and their platforms and their actions on the ground approaching the parliamentary and presidential elections. And I would divide the actors we are looking at in Egypt based on a trilateral division, government, formal opposition, and what I mean here are formal established legal political parties and informal opposition networks of activists and opposition dynamics. Now, the government is basically, to my mind, is undertaking five interesting or using five tools, which are well known and have always been used. Rejecting any amendment that would change the restrictive nature of the legal and constitutional environment. As I said, no constitutional amendment, continuation and renewal of the state of emergency, and so on and so forth. Secondly, targeted repression to opposition activists and opposition leaders. Third, the government is trying to periodize the way it approaches the political calendar, the political cycle of Egypt, into a division between parliamentary elections that everyone should focus on right now and the postponed discussion about presidential elections, which should start unfolding after the parliamentary elections. Of course, parliamentary elections are going to be the scene setter in different ways for the presidential election, but the government is trying to say, let's do the parliamentary elections first, fair and free and pluralist. We have parties which run. President Mubarak said that a few days ago. And let's postpone discussion on the presidential elections to 2011. In a way, trying to push Al-Baradi to a marginal place in the Egyptian public and political debate. Four, the government is trying to use its influence on legal established political parties to make sure that they will stay on its side. Parties such as Al-Wafd, the Liberal Wafd, or parties such as the leftist Unionist Party, Al-Tagammu, or other parties which have come to depend on the government to secure their share in the People's Assembly, their minimal share in the People's Assembly and the Shura Council, continue to depend on the government, and in a way continue to be co-opted and domesticated, a domesticated opposition of sorts. This is continuing as well. Finally, once again, a reform-based, a democracy-based government rhetoric, which is becoming less and less credible, because even if you take items such as ending the state of emergency, President Mubarak promised to do it in 2005, it's yet to be done. They promised to ease restrictions on political parties, it's yet to be done. They promised to replace the judicial supervision of elections with a national council, a national commission on elections that is independent and neutral, and this is not the case. So, however, we still have a democracy-based government rhetoric that is trying to say, well, parliamentary elections will be conducted fair and free. The president himself said that he is happy to see Egyptians becoming more interested in politics. The last statement, dynamism and mobility are good. So we still have parts of that as well. The second component, I'm running out of time. Still have 5 months, okay. Second component is formal, conventional, or legal political parties. And as I said, we can, apart from junior parties such as the Democratic Front of Osama al-Ghazali Harb, or al-Ghad, which is divided and embattled internally, legal political parties have come to be co-opted by the government and depend on the government in securing their share. So do not expect much from them. In fact, they are even not endorsing the demands put forward by informal opposition groups or by activists to amend the constitution, to ease restrictions. They are not even endorsing the demands to push for democratic reforms in Egypt. What we should keep in mind is that those parties, in spite of the fact that they, in some cases, have a good infrastructure and have representation across the country, such as Al-Wafd. Al-Wafd is the only party, apart from the National Democratic ruling National Democratic Party, which has branches everywhere in Egypt. It's the only party which has branches everywhere. Apart from the fact that they do have an infrastructure and organizational solidity of sorts, they are inactive and have lost credibility. The third component, which is sort of, once again, the source, just like 2004 and 2005, the source of injection of dynamism into Egyptian politics is informal opposition. And while we had, as I said, in 2004 and 2005, Kifaya, we have this time al-Baradi and his movement for change, and we continue to have the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, the big change in relation to the informal opposition dynamics is that in 2004 and 2005, the Muslim Brotherhood was seen as the leading actor. In 2010, I dare say that it's not the case. The Muslim Brotherhood is trying to join, to harmonize its activism, its actions on the ground, with the demands and the platform of the national movement for change. Today, the march, which was supposed to address demands for constitutional change to Speaker of Parliament, was co-organized by the Muslim Brotherhood and the National Movement for Change of al-Baradi, and there are other different signs. The platform goes in the right direction, as I outlined at the beginning. However, what the group of al-Baradi lacks is an action plan, and a plan which addresses the question of what's next. What if the government refuses and continues to reject successfully demands to amend the constitution? What if Dr. al-Baradi cannot run in the presidential elections of 2011? What are they going to do about the parliamentary elections? What are they going to do if he cannot run? Do they have a platform on concrete social, economic, and political issues? Is it a platform for national consensus, for change, or is it a platform as well for actions in a tough political cycle and the tough political calendar we are looking at? They lack that. As I said at the beginning, Dr. al-Baradi brings in international recognition and a degree of domestic recognition. However, he has been attacked systematically by the semi-government press, by government voices, as someone who does not know much about Egypt. He romanticized a bit at the beginning about Egyptian society and what we call in Egypt al-Ashwaiyat, which are places where impoverished sections of the population live, around Cairo and in big urban centers. He romanticized a bit, giving a chance for the government voices to criticize him as someone who does not know the country really. Secondly, he has been pushed by some elements, some members inside his group, to address issues which, to my mind, he should not address, such as the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty, the wall in Gaza. So he moved from a domestic-based platform into addressing some regional issues, and here he is being criticized. However, in spite of those government-sponsored attacks on him, he still represents a big shift in the informal opposition spectrum as compared to 2004 and 2005. We have a candidate who can be reckoned with and who everyone is taking seriously in Egypt and probably outside. Finally, Al-Ikhwan, the Muslim Brotherhood, as part of the informal opposition spectrum, I suspect two main features to understand what the Muslim Brotherhood is probably going to do in 2010-2011. A, the movement is recovering from a period of instability, which the movement had to go through between 06, 07, and 2009. It's re-stabilizing. It's finally developing, once again, a platform about domestic issues in Egypt. The movement in 07, 08, and 09 was debating primarily its own internal affairs. Sort of the clearest sign was the last elections, internal elections for the guidance office. It's re-stabilizing. It's recovering, developing a domestic platform, but unlike 2004 and 2005, it's no longer the leading part in the informal spectrum. It's joining the platform and the demands put forward by Baradei and his group. Secondly, I suspect that the movement is going to practice its role in Egyptian politics in 2010, 2011 based on the self-limiting principle. I do not see the movement hoping to get more than a couple of seats in the Shura Council elections, if any, and Michel reminded me of the fact that they never managed to win a single seat in the Shura Council. I do not see the movement expecting to win more than maybe anywhere between 10 and 20, and this is based on interviews which my colleague Nathan Brown and myself conducted recently with Ikhwan's leaders. They do not expect to have more than anywhere between 10 and 20, which would mean down from 88, from a big parliamentary bloc into a tiny representation. I do not see the movement provoking the Egyptian government by using the street intensively. They would probably continue to co-organize events and demonstrations with al-Baradei or informal opposition actors, but they would not use the street intensively to avoid provoking the government. Finally, the big question, should the constitution be amended, which I do not see happening, should the constitution be amended, Article 76, to enable independence to run, the big question becomes, would the Muslim Brotherhood nominate an independent candidate? Because once you make the conditions more flexible, theoretically they can field the candidate, they could field the candidate. Should that happen, and I do not see it happening, should that happen, I suspect that the movement would try to keep al-Baradei as the single opposition candidate and would, in fact, even without endorsing him, either play it based on the gray zone model, which they have always used successfully, endorsing and not endorsing, or at any rate, not fielding a candidate against him, a second opposition candidate against him. I hope this gives you an idea of what's going on in Egypt, and I would be happy to take your questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Amr. Okay, now we're going to have some comments by Jeremy Sharp, and I think Jeremy is going to comment on the situation in Egypt as well as sort of putting it in a regional context and a little bit of a U.S. policy context.
Thanks, Michelle. And thank you to the Carnegie Endowment for having me today. Thank you to Amr for your presentation, always insightful. Those of us who are desk jockeys in Washington rely on your analysis tremendously, so thank you. And thank you to Michelle for having me. I've told you this in private, but I'll tell you in public, you've always been a role model. So I appreciate your expertise and combined with a refreshing sense of humility, so thank you. As Michelle said, I'm going to expand on Amr's presentation specifically from a U.S. policy standpoint. And I'd like to go back to what he was saying about the renewal of the emergency laws, because I think we're going to be talking about elections, Egyptian elections in this town for the next 2 years. We still have some time. But the emergency laws is a policy issue that's happening right now. On May 26th of 2008, the People's Assembly renewed them for 2 years. So this is something that could happen potentially this month. Now, in April, the April 6th movement protest, In response, the State Department issued a statement saying, quote, "We are deeply concerned about the arrest of Egyptians under the emergency law," referring to the emergency law. Then Gamal last week, as Amr mentioned, said, quote, this is commenting on a possible extension. He said, this is from Al-Masri Al-Yam, "The party will ask the government to place some additional controls on the state of emergency if it has to extend it, in such a way as to be bound by some guarantees and pledges that the application be confined to the crimes and threats of terrorism only." Of course, this is referring to the possible anti-terrorism legislation that has been talked about for quite some time. So with the emergency law, I'd like to sort of pose a question. What is our government, what is the administration doing right now, and what has it been doing in the past few months to address this extension? Are there discussions behind closed doors about it? If it's extended, how are we going to react? And I sort of looked up past statements on the extension. So in 2006, State Department said, quote, "It's a disappointment," and then referred to President Mubarak's campaign pledge in 2005 to abrogate the emergency law and have some new anti-terrorism legislation. In 2008, when it was extended, quote, "It's disappointing that they did decide to extend the state of emergency. We would urge them to pass a law," and then it goes on to talk about the anti-terrorism law. So again, this is something to look at now. It can be sort of a barometer for how our government reacts to parliamentary elections later this year and then to presidential elections in 2011. Amr also sort of got at this notion of confrontation, and I think it's very important. We were discussing this earlier. What happens when push comes to shove for El-Baradei's movement? Does he have the stomach for confrontation, either or violent or nonviolent? And I was looking at this Egyptian blogger, many of you know Bahia. She wrote, quote, El-Baradei raises the costs of electoral engineering. And I guess I would sort of think about it, if El-Baradei is not able to peel off NDP elites to his cause, if he's not able to get more establishment support, what next? What is he going to do to sort of raise the stakes? Saad Eddine Rahim recently said for El-Baradei to follow the path, quote, of civil disobedience and to make sacrifices like Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. How is he going to do this without provoking severe response from the security forces? How are the security forces going to respond to him if he's, quote, as Egyptians say, an international? Is he courting the security forces? What is that relationship going on? Is he trying to? I think he said some things in public that would probably anger the Egyptian military and the interior security, criticizing, as Amr mentioned, the steel barrier going up in Rafah, which Egyptians feel is very much a national security issue. Finally, we're going to talk about elections, and we always talk about reform, but it's always very important to just put it in a regional context. This morning, Prime Minister Netanyahu, as all of you read, is in Sharm el-Sheikh. The proximity talks are about to be restarted. The Arab League has endorsed this now twice, thanks to a strong role that Egypt has played in this. Egypt this morning declared a national emergency on their border with Rafah, fearing another Hamas border breach in retaliation for the four tunnelers who were killed last week. So we can't dismiss the regional context. It's very important. The peace process is something that is going to be important for this administration for the time being. And while we would like to think that pushing political reform and the peace process are not mutually exclusive, it's a very hard act to do. And I'm certainly not in government in that position. And I feel badly for those people who have to sort of walk that fine line. But it's something to look at very carefully. Hopefully we can sort of flush this out more in questions and answers. So thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy. Okay. Well, I don't know about all of you. I have a whole bunch of questions, but I'm going to take the privilege of asking one or two quickly before I open up the floor. Amr, I want to ask you, in the light of everything that you described, and in the light of a fairly restrictive legal and constitutional environment, and so forth. So, what do elections really count for in Egypt at this point? Why are they important? Are they important? What would be the significance? I mean, what would come out of these? Let's just look at the parliamentary elections for the moment. Focus on that. What's the significance of this? What kind of impact can whatever happens in the parliamentary elections have on Egypt as a nation going forward, and possibly on the presidential election and succession process after that? That's question number one. The other one is just a shorter one. You know, I was kind of intrigued by what you were saying about the Muslim Brotherhood being resigned to winning only, say, 10 to 20 seats in the parliament this time around, as opposed to the 88 they got 5 years ago. So what does that mean? Do they believe that they will not be able to field as many candidates that they'll face, for example, the refusal to register their candidates that they faced in local elections over the past couple of years? Do they think there will be more rigging in the elections? I mean, at the actual polling places, do they think that they have less support? Do they think they're going to be less able to mobilize people to go out and vote for them?
Well, thank you very much, Michelle. Let me start with the second question. On the Muslim Brotherhood, it's a mix of the different factors which you refer to. The movement, in spite of its 88 seats, has presented itself to its constituents, to the wider Egyptian public, as in the last years, between 2005 and 2010, as a divided movement, as a movement which does not have a clear platform on different domestic issues. All of us do remember the debate which took place in relation to the draft party platform, which was released in 2007. The more recent debate following the guidance office prior and during and following the guidance office elections, the internal elections in the movement did not present itself as a solid, homogeneous movement with a clear platform to convince Egyptians. In fact, there are different accounts, and I tend to go in that direction, that the movements with different steps have angered core constituents by becoming more interested in socioeconomic issues in the People's Assembly and less interested in moral Sharia-driven issues by pushing for a draft party platform that did not, for the core constituency of religious-inspired Muslim Brotherhood supporters, that did not go enough in the direction of pushing for an application of Sharia and so on and so forth. So definitely factor A, less support. Secondly, which is more significant, is, and based on the experience between 2006, 2007, up until now, the movement knows that the government will not let it register and run as many candidates as it did in 2005. In 2005, some of you might remember, the movement ran 150. Candidates ended up winning 88 seats. In the local council elections of 2007, the movement, in spite of its attempt to field over 1,000, if I'm not mistaken, ended up managing to register less than 20 and boycotted the elections for what it described as regime outright repression. They know that they will not be allowed to run as many candidates. In a way, the government in Egypt, post-2005, is probably less interested, less keen on rigging the elections and more keen on transferring the manipulation to the day prior to the election day. So sort of the manipulation takes place before you go to the polls. Thirdly, what do they do out of that? I guess the movement has always managed to contain regime hits and ups and downs in their political representation, in fact, in a very good manner, depending on the social and wider religious and social da'wah activities, social and religious activities, which they have always invested in. So they take it into consideration, and I do not see them protesting against it in any meaningful way. On elections, and what do they count for, and focusing on the parliamentary elections, well, they do count for, to my mind, if you look at it from a government perspective, from within the ruling establishment, the parliamentary elections of 2010 for the Shura Council and People's Assembly are going to be a new test for Gamal Mubarak and his group. Can they manage it? I mean, as you know, and we were discussing it earlier, in 2005, NDP candidates, straightforward NDP candidates, did not win more than 30% of the seats of the People's Assembly. The NDP came to its two-thirds majority because the so-called NDP independents rejoined the party after the elections. This was a test which was, in fact, a failure for Gamal and his group. Now, he is going to be tested for a second time in 2010 in relation to parliamentary elections. The parliamentary elections, the result of the parliamentary elections, are going to represent a scene setter for the presidential elections. Are we going to have a People's Assembly with 20-25% opposition representation or 5-10% opposition representation, which would be a sign for a presidential contest or presidential elections that will not are not going to be in any way more pluralist than the ones which we have in 2005. Parliamentary elections are influential because they are going definitely to clarify the relative weight and the potential significance of different opposition moves. We are going to see approaching the parliamentary elections, can the movement of Dr. Baradei bring down its platform on constitutional amendments and democracy into an action plan, into steps? Can they field candidates? Can they run election campaigns? Yes or no? Or would they face the same limitations which Kifaya faced in 2004 and 2005 and ended up being a movement that put forward all the right demands but did not push significantly for any one of them? Because imagining that you can generate in Egypt enough popular pressure to force the government to change is misleading. So elections are significant because we are going to test the impact of the constitutional amendments, removing judicial oversight. What does it mean on the ground? Everyone is pushing for international monitoring and domestic monitoring for the first time. Egyptian opposition, religious, unreligious, liberal, leftists are pushing for that. Is that going to materialize? Is the government going to accept it? So there are different questions which are key for Egyptian politics where we can use the elections as a test case. Are the elections going to change Egyptian politics to push for more democratization? No. As far as I can tell, the government is going to play it as it has always played it, in a semi-pluralist, in a restrictive manner, and this will not change.
Thank you, Amr. And Jeremy, I just want to ask you a little bit more about sort of the choices for the United States and its policy toward Egypt as we move toward these elections. You mentioned the regional context and how important the Israeli-Palestinian peace process is to the administration. Could you reflect for us a little bit the thinking that you hear, whether within the administration or on Capitol Hill, about this kind of thing? Is there a sense that is there a sense of concern that President Mubarak or others in the Egyptian leadership would not put forward effort on the Arab-Israeli peace process if the United States were raising at the same time issues related to democracy and elections and so forth? Or is there a more fundamental concern that somehow if the United States starts, you know, pressing a little bit more for democracy, that there would actually be a leadership change that could go against U.S. interests? I mean, what is the kind of concerns that you hear more from your perch at CRS? And the other thing is this issue of international monitoring that Amr raised, that he feels the, you know, there's much more acceptance of this, at least in the opposition in Egypt, that international monitoring of elections would be desirable. Do you think this is, you know, has this sort of come to the minds of people on the Hill, for example, yet, you know, pushing for international monitoring of the elections?
Sure. Thank you. The Egyptian government's position and perception in Washington, frankly, is quite strong. There's a very positive atmosphere surrounding U.S.-Egyptian bilateral relations, more so than there's been in recent years. Now, that could somewhat change as we get closer into election season, but it's partially a byproduct of very strong, again, government-to-government Egyptian-Israeli relations. Some observers have observed that Egyptian-Israeli relations are maybe not people-to-people, but at a government-to-government level, better than they've been in many years. And I think there's some proof to that and some truth to that. So I think, sort of relate it back to what's going on in Capitol Hill, for those of you who have been here for several years, you'll remember the conditionality language on Egypt's foreign aid that was passed several years ago. It was tied to a number of things, to judicial reform, human rights, but also tied to Egyptian's position vis-a-vis the smuggling between Egypt and Gaza. And that, I would say, by far was the driver behind that conditionality language. It was a regional context. Now, people would have liked to have thought that it was because of its political reform record, but it had to do very much more with the Arab-Israeli conflict and how it plays out in Washington. So I guess the general point is, as long as Egyptian or Israeli government-to-government relations are strong, it's going to be harder for Washington in this town to sort of take a much tougher approach on the political reform issue. And those relations aren't changing exactly just yet. In terms of international monitoring, I think AID has a very sort of robust technical assistance program, from what I've seen. I haven't seen everything relating to the elections. I think the position is that they're training Egyptian domestic monitors. Now, the role of, to the best of my knowledge, of international monitoring is not something that we're. I don't know if it's. I'm sure we're contemplating it. It's not something certainly that we're from a programmatic level that's happening at the moment. You know, we're just getting into sort of Egyptian election season here in Washington, so perhaps this could become more of an issue, but it hasn't to this point.
Okay, thank you. All right, so we'll open it up for questions now. We do have a microphone, so please, I'll recognize you, and then this gentleman here can have the first question. And please identify yourself, ask your question, and then let me know if there's a specific panelist you want to answer you.
Question to Amr Hamzawi. My name is Amin Mahmoud. I'm an Egyptian American. We have to remember that the Baradei movement is 2 months and 10 days. We have to be fair with him. And his movement getting a lot of momentum now, and he depend on the mandate of people to sign for him. If you have a 1 million signature, he can influence Washington and the Egyptian government as well. He is not depending on Washington to do anything because he know the situation which Jeremy talk about. I'd like to see your opinion.
Okay. Do you like to collect questions and take some individually? Okay. Well, right. Thank you very much. Of course, I see your point. And in fairness to El Baradei, his movement is new, has changed in fact, in a few weeks, has changed the appearance of Egyptian politics. I mean, I refer to words such as stagnation, stalemate, too much stability, which we use to employ and use to characterize Egyptian politics right now. I mean, we can use different words. We use different words, dynamic, becoming more interesting, or once again interesting, and so on and so forth. However, and I do agree with much of what El Baradei's movement has been putting forward, demands for constitutional change, changing the restrictive legal environment, and he is definitely correct on saying that without changing the environment, it makes no sense to continue and regenerate a game of limited political competition, which leads only to legitimizing whatever the regime tries to get out of elections, parliamentary or presidential, and legitimizing the outcome as democratic, and it's not. So here there is much credit to be given to Dr. Baradei, where he and his movement have not developed enough answers up until now, is to my mind at two levels. A, how to translate the platform into an action plan. And it's not enough to say that, well, let's try to get Egyptians to demonstrate on a daily basis, because they are not going to do it. And it's not enough to tell Egyptians, get out of your place and demonstrate for constitutional change and democracy, unless you relate it in a meaningful way to their daily life, to the social and economic conditions under which a great majority of Egyptians has been living, and those conditions have been deteriorating. Unless you do that, and they have not been able to do it. Second, so you need an action plan. Secondly, I see no good reason for Dr. Baradei to keep shifting from a focus which I would say is more than important on domestic issues into statements on regional and international issues that are only, in fact, eating away from his international and parts of his domestic credibility. Thirdly, and Jeremy's point was very significant, asking, is Dr. Baradei trying to appeal to at least components or parts of the ruling establishment or not? I mean, Egypt, change in Egyptian politics, an opening in Egyptian politics of sorts, will not happen against the will of the ruling establishment. You have to find ways to dialogue at least with them. Is he dialoguing with anyone? I do not have that impression. And his last statements on Gaza, on the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty, as Jeremy mentioned, have led to anger among the military establishment, security and intelligence establishment, and unfortunately he is still trying to, in an undecided manner, to play a double-sided game of I am here because I'm interested in reforming Egypt, and I do not have to be a candidate in the presidential elections. And, well, I am the candidate for Egyptians in the presidential elections if you give me your mandate and if we can change the environment. He has to become more clear on, A, what does he stand for, B, what is... how to tackle the question, what's next if the government refuses to amend the constitution? And he has to become clear on, is he part of it, or is he only sort of a temporary phenomenon which will wither away and disappear once the government says no to constitutional amendments, and once we have as we had in 2005, parliamentary and presidential elections that are not going to lead to any change. We still have a Mubarak maybe up there, and we still have a comfortable majority for the NDP in the People's Assembly.
Okay.
So I want to get clarity on this. Is El
Could you identify yourself, please?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Nervat Hatin. I mean, is this a movement for change or is it more of the same? And is, I mean, I was interested in the international dimension, not in relation to the U.S., but in relation to the fact that privatization in Egypt has accelerated during the last several years, and therefore international investors as well as donors might not necessarily be interested in change, and that the only movement in fairly large numbers that is connected to some significant change is the workers' movement, but that, of course, is not really part of this movement for change. And therefore, I mean, so what are we looking at, sort of more of the same? I mean, you mentioned, Amr, that it was more or less a repeat of 2005 and 2006, and therefore, and they haven't learned the lessons of that particular period. So why would there be any attempt at sort of thinking of them as associated with a significant movement for change? Is it more of the same, or is it really some kind of change?
I'm going to collect a couple more questions. Right here, Mame.
Cynthia Anthony with American University in Cairo. Just a quick question. What does the Kefaya movement as such still exist? What's happened to those supporters? Have they gone over to the Movement for Change or gone elsewhere, or hopefully not? Have they...
Mm-hmm. I'll have one more question, and then we'll answer a few. I'll come back.
I'm Rafi Danziger from APAC, and my first question is directed to Amr, and that is with regard to the NPT review conference that began today. There are reports that Egypt is pushing very hard for a resolution that would put the Israeli nuclear program on the agenda, and I was wondering if perhaps this is also driven to some extent by fear that Al-Baradei is going to use this issue, which is his baby, really, if Egypt doesn't push hard enough on that. And to Jeremy, what do you think is the American position on that issue of the nuclear-free Middle East?
Okay, let's answer those, and then we'll come back for some more questions.
Mervat's question. Well, 2 points here. One, It is in a way different and more significant than 2004 and 2005 because of Al-Baradei's personality. And this was a great handicap in 2004 and 2005 when Egyptians looked at what Kefaya was saying or what the informal opposition spectrum was putting forward. They saw demands, but they saw personalities, which were acting in a very weird manner, not saying the right things which needed to be said. Baradei, in the first weeks, I would say, really did a very good job in highlighting the issue, putting the demands forward, making it clear that, well, amending the constitution is significant and important. But then I expected him to move beyond that in the direction of, A, reaching out to big constituencies. And you mentioned one key constituency, Jeremy mentioned one, which is the ruling establishment. Is he trying to reach out to them, to components at least? Maybe some are not or are yet to be satisfied with the possibility of the Gamal Mubarak succession. Has he been reaching out to the ruling establishment? And you mentioned the second big constituency, workers, and those who stand behind the social and economic protest activism that has been gaining more ground in Egypt, at least in terms of the quantity of total number of protest activities. He hasn't been doing a good job. I mean, there was only one statement from Baradei on May 1 addressed to Egyptian workers, congratulating them and asking them to join his movement for change, that change cannot be reached without the working class. But there are no serious attempts, and I relate all that to the fact that they do not have an action plan. Secondly, on the international environment, I would say I mean, one of the assets of Dr. Baradei is that he appeals to, at least theoretically, he appeals to the to external actors as someone who is known to be a liberal, who does not come in or did not go to Egypt with a revolutionary agenda changing Egyptian regional and international preferences. In fact, he was looked at the beginning as someone who represents a continuity when it comes to regional and international preferences of Egypt and represents a good positive change, a democratic change domestically. Theoretically, someone like Baradei should appeal to external actors at the government-to-government level as well as to non-governmental, be it international investors or otherwise. However, he, to my mind, and here once again I criticize him and criticize the movement, he put forward some statements which did not serve to that end. As I say, once again, Gaza, the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty, he had an episode in which he addressed the Nasserist era positively than negatively, Sadat's and Fatah policy positively than negatively, and he created the impression of someone who is being driven by a group of politicians, politicians who are now around him. I'm not going to refer to names. Without knowing where he really stands and not making it clear for Egyptians where he stands. Second point, Cynthia, is on kifaya. Well, there are two kifayas. There is a kifaya of Abd al-Halim Andil, and a kifaya Abd al-Halim Andil, you know him. If you live in Egypt, you have to know him. You cannot avoid knowing Abd al-Halim. Okay, that's good. So I do not envy you. And now Abd al-Halim Andil's wing decided not to join the National Movement for Change of Dr. Baradei and is still calling for a 1 million strong demonstration to topple the regime and take over the state, which will never happen. And the second wing of Kifaya around George Isha'i and some other activists, liberal and leftist, have joined the National Movement for Change and are becoming active, are active. Unfortunately, some of them are responsible for the mistakes of Dr. Baradei, which I refer to, sort of addressing regional and international issues where it's not needed to do so. On the NPT final question, no, I do not see it driven by domestic considerations. It's more driven by the regional competition between Egypt, Turkey, and Iran, and the need for Egypt, Egyptian foreign policy, to put forward a platform of sorts. An NPT, a Middle East free of nuclear weapons, is becoming once again an integral part of what the Egyptians are putting forward, and I would say rightly so, as a model for the region.
Marina.
Do you want me to respond?
I'm sorry. I didn't allow Jeremy to respond. Please.
It's okay.
I'm sorry.
After I said you were a role model, it's a hard thing to stomach.
Feet of clay.
Get me back for that later. Rafi, that was a very good question. I guess my response is, as you know, this has been a long-standing position. And I think it's being pushed more aggressively now because, frankly, it's on the table as an administration policy, not nuclear-free Middle East, but, I mean, just the issue of talking about these things. But at the same time, I mean, Mubarak has also said in public that an Iranian weapon would change our calculation. And so, you know, what does that mean, too? So, I mean, there are statements on either side that you can look at. It's also very interesting that these statements are being made, not more aggressively, just more publicly, in the context of ongoing U.S.-Egyptian and U.S.-Jordanian 1-2-3 nuclear cooperation negotiations, and how these statements will play into those bilateral negotiations, I'm not sure.
Mervat preempted the first part of my question, which was really on the sort of the protest movement. But I'd like to push you on another potential constituency. If you look, where is the discontent in the country? And certainly there is the socioeconomic discontent. Then you have also mentioned another aspect, which is the discontent within the Juan, the people who do not think that the policies of the present parliamentary delegation represents what they have. Is there, you know, is that a constituency that's getting mobilized in any form? And if it does get mobilized, would it be mobilized against El Baradei rather than on the same side?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're going to take a couple of more questions. This lady in the front here has been waiting patiently.
My question is, so
could you identify yourself? Thank you.
Oh, my name is Nadia Sa- Assad. I'm retired from the World Bank, but I'm a student of Middle Eastern studies. You talked very little about the formal opposition in Egypt. Now, I would like to know how strong is the Liberal Party of Osama, Raza Ali Harb, and what was his position? What is his position towards the Baradei? Is there any other opposition, formal opposition? And that's one question. The other question is that, don't you think that El Baradei, by talking about Gaza, is counting on the sentiment of, let's say, the Egyptian street of the people?
Right.
Okay, we'll take one more. This lady on the same side.
Oh, thank you. Hello. My name is Nasima Noor. I'm with the National Democratic Institute. I wanted to ask Dr. Hamzawi a question regarding what he called a test case, how the parliamentary elections will be a test case for the constitutional amendments and the lack of judicial oversight. I was wondering if you also consider the parliamentary elections, or you think it might be a test case with regard to President Mubarak passing power to his son Gamal, if the government sees the election somehow as, I guess, a harbinger. If there aren't as many protests, for example, or if the protests die down, it might signal to them that the public will, in fact, accept the secession.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Let's go ahead and answer
right.
this.
Mm-hmm. Marina, your question on discontent and constituencies, different constituencies in Egypt. On Al-Ikhwan, yes. And there are some signs. There is good evidence, in fact, that some of Al-Ikhwan's members, primarily young generation members and supporters, who became disillusioned with the movement in the last years for different reasons, lack of effectiveness of the parliamentary platform, the appearance of the movement as a divided movement, the inability of the movement to move in a clear direction toward moderation, equality between Muslims and Copts, sort of endorse equal citizenship rights, equality between men and women, the inability of Al-Ikhwan to project a clear vision. There is some evidence that those are moving and are becoming more inspired by Al-Baradei and by the national movement for change, but they were also inspired by a movement like April 6. Some of them joined April 6 as a protest network. So yes, is Al-Baradei or his group trying to reach out systematically to those? No, they are not doing it. But they are also not reaching out to potential very significant constituencies in Egypt. Well, I would have imagined someone like Al-Baradei to try to reach out to the business community, because with his assets, he should be more appealing to the business community than, let us say, Hamdin Sabahi of the Nasserist Karama Party, or someone like Osama Al-Ghazali Harb of the Liberal National Democratic Front or Democratic Front. I would have imagined Baradei to do more. He has done some of that in terms of reaching out to the Coptic community in Egypt. I mean, there were some signs. He went to the Easter service, attended the Easter service, some debates in Egypt which were inspired by that, but he hasn't done enough in terms of reaching out to Copts as a constituency as well, be it in Egypt or outside Egypt. So in overall, his movement lacks an action plan which a political actor would need approaching parliamentary and presidential elections. Can they put it forward? I really doubt it very much. Now, second question by Nadia on formal opposition parties and Osama al-Ghazali Harb's Democratic Front specifically. Well, formal opposition parties, you can look at them using sort of a simple duality. Established parties such as the Liberal WAFD, Leftist Unionist Party, have bought into the semi-pluralism of Egyptian politics a long time ago. They have become, you can use a decent phrase like domesticated opposition, or a less decent phrase, co-opted by the government, but there's not much to be expected from them. And then you have a second component, parties which were recently legalized, were allowed, received a license from the committee that license political parties and that is controlled by the NDP and the government. Democratic Front of Osama al-Ghazali Harb is one of them. They are trying to get active in Egypt based on a double-sided strategy. One, they try to make it clear in the public space that formal established
opposition parties are not doing what they are expected to do, and secondly, they are trying to join the informal opposition spectrum. So Osama al-Ghazali Harb is a founding member of the National Movement for Change. His party has done a try to co-organize some of the events with April 6th, with the National Movement for Change of al-Baradei. However, let's keep in mind that the share of Egyptians, which I should have said that at the very beginning, I mean the share of Egyptians who have been participating in those activities, formal opposition, informal opposition, Ikhwan or otherwise, Baradei or otherwise, is not more than 10% of eligible voters. So let's keep the dimension in mind. We still are looking at a very tiny share of eligible voters, and the clear majority remains, unfortunately, influenced by political apathy and by deteriorating social economic conditions, which eat away from their capacity to become interested in public affairs. Nasima, on yes, it's very much a test case for Gamal Mubarak and for the succession scenario as well. As I said, and this was part of a discussion which Michelle and I had earlier today, 2005 was the elections, was managed from an NDP perspective by Gamal and his group, especially the first phase. They failed drastically. Then the management of elections was taken over by the security apparatus and by the so-called old guard inside the party. This time, Gamal and his group, and you can see that if you look at Ahmed Izz and his role in nominating and fielding, agreeing on the candidates who are going to be nominated for the NDP, the elections are going to be managed by Gamal and his group, and a second test case, can he do it or not? And I would relate to that the issue which you mentioned on popular discontent. Are we going to see clear and clear signs of popular discontent, or is it going to be accepted and moderated in public opinion views and trends, in a way giving a chance for the succession scenario?
Thanks. Jeremy.
Yeah, just very briefly on your question, it's a very good one. And of course, playing the populism card is a good tactic. But I guess what we were saying earlier is the military and security forces, they are a constituency. So you can play the popular card without alienating the military and security section. Why do that so early on in the game? As like someone in the audience said, he's only been in Egypt for 2.5 months. And so if you're going to take this sort of Obama approach and reach out to all these different constituencies, you probably it's not the best tactic to sort of anger the army from the get-go.
Okay. Question here. Laura Schultz?
Thanks.
You're on my list. Don't worry.
Thanks. Laura Schultz from Congressional Research Service. Question for Amr. Building on the discussion about Baradei's constituency and areas where he hasn't been as effective in reaching out and cultivating support, where has he been successful? To the extent that there are indicators that there's support outside of Cairo, that there's support anywhere beyond this 10% that you just talked about, that's kind of the traditional politically active. What is your sense of kind of the composition of his movement at this point?
Okay. Back of the room. What does?
Thanks, Michelle. Amr and Jeremy, thank you so much.
Could you introduce yourself?
I'm Mataz Zahran. I'm with the Embassy of Egypt.
Thank you.
I would probably just start by agreeing with Amr that politics has never been clean or never been innocent anywhere, in Egypt or in any other place. I will probably just distance myself just a little bit or maybe just a significant part in characterizing the political space in Egypt as being corrupt. It's too general, too wide in nature. No one's perfect, and nothing is perfect. I would just jump from that to ask you a question on the what you see. Is there a room in your analysis that would attribute the current mobility, as you've characterized it, or dynamism in Egypt, in politics, to the latest developments since 2004, as you've referred to 2005 with the amendments to the Constitution, 2007 with sweeping other amendments? Is there room in your analysis to attribute the current dynamism in Egypt to that. Now, I'll just jump to the Baradei factor, as you called it. He's been criticized in Egypt by many. He's also been praised by many, and he's been supported by many. This is probably an essence of a democratic exchange. Is there room? What do you think hinders him from joining at least a dozen parties from 24, from joining one of these parties and presenting himself as a candidate? One last point on the emergency law. I don't like it, and I don't think anyone here from whether in this room or at the embassy even likes the emergency law. Many of my colleagues also in Egypt don't like it and are working for its abolishment. There's a fine line between guaranteeing civil liberties and facing security challenges and threats that needs to be preserved, whether through an emergency law or through an anti-terrorism law. Referring to the law in terms of, or attributing incidents,
we have a question.
Very quickly, incidents to the emergency law is probably simply faulty. Those on the 6th of April were questioned and released according to regular laws that apply. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. We'll take one more question right now from right back here from, I think it's, yeah, Mark Plattner. Please identify yourself.
Mark Plattner, Journal of Democracy.
Yes.
I just wanted to ask what we know about the state of President Mubarak's health, and even if to what we know it's in good shape, still the man is quite old. You're talking about a 15-month process. What happens if he were to become incapacitated or die and somewhere in the middle of this? Is it chaos? What might be the effect?
Turns 82 tomorrow.
Right. Tomorrow.
Right. No? Okay.
Okay. Let me start with your question, Mark. It's what I can say is that according to the Constitution, and based on the constitutional amendments of 2007, if the president is incapacitated, this was one of the amendments that injected a new element in the constitution. If the president is incapacitated, we have 60 days in which the Speaker of the People's Assembly, in which the president will have to announce, or it will have to be announced that the president is incapacitated. The Speaker of the People's Assembly calls for elections in 60 days. So according to the Constitution, there is a way, a scenario to manage the situation should Egypt's president become incapacitated. The second point, let me just say that it's never chaos in Egypt. I mean, we are looking at a strong state, and in spite of the different difficulties which state institutions have been running into, lack of legitimacy, deteriorating social and economic conditions, growing signs for popular discontent, state institutions are still able to manage changes, even at the highest level in terms of managing politics in the presidency, according to the agreed upon set of rules and regulations. The big question in Egypt, which no one can really answer, and there are controversial signs, is basically, and to put it in a nutshell, does the ruling establishment have any different alternative succession scenario apart from the Gamal succession scenario, yes or no? So is it only a one shot which they are taking to put Mubarak Jr. in place of Mubarak Sr., between 2010, 2011, or are there alternative scenarios? Before the president's sickness, it was widely debated in Egypt that President Mubarak himself is going to run for a sixth term in 2011. And this was becoming to be sort of the most expected scenario. Humbly, I would say this is becoming less and less feasible in view of the sickness and in view of the fact that President Mubarak, for the first time, disappeared for several weeks
from the scene and physically disappeared. News coverage on the president disappeared as well. So the question is, does the ruling establishment have, apart from the Gamal scenario, other succession scenarios? I would expect that they must have Plan B and Plan C, but what those are, they're only rumors. A military establishment representative, a consensus figure, a Omar Suleiman figure, or Omar Suleiman himself. I mean, but you know that. Constituencies where Baradei, your question, Laura, where Baradei has been successful, to my mind, Baradei has been successful in relation primarily, which is a surprise, in relation to Egyptians residing outside Egypt. This is where we have had the clearest signs of support for Baradei, in Kuwait, in the UAE, as well as in the US, really across the board. Domestically, Al-Baradei has been successful in mobilizing, tapping into youth activism, young generation activism, but he did not shape it. It was out there since 2005, 2006, April 6 movement, similar movements, young members in Ikhwan, young member elsewhere. He has been able to tap into that and mobilize them. And those are the ones who have created the Facebook presence of Al-Baradei, his website, Twitter presence, and so on and so forth, and are participating in different attempts to demonstrate, because, I mean, you cannot say demonstrations in Egypt. There are attempts to demonstrate or to do popular march, and sometimes they are hindered by the security apparatus. Mu'taz, no, I do not see it related to the I do not see the current dynamism or mobility related to the constitution amendments of 2005 and 2007, for the simple reason that prior to 2005 and 2007, we had, as I said, a similar wave of political dynamism. And when I look at the details of the constitutional amendments, most of the amendments are undemocratically spirited. Apart from some interesting amendments, transferring, sort of replacing the prime minister, replacing the vice president with the prime minister in terms of who takes over when the president is temporarily not incapacitated, but is cannot perform his job. So no, I do not see it related to that. It's a good question. Why is Al-Baradei saying that he will only run as an independent candidate and he will only run on the presidential ballot provided the government amends the constitution to allow for independents to run? And well knowing that easing restrictions on independence might lead to a Muslim Brotherhood candidate as well. Why is he saying no to joining a political party? And he was called on to do that by President Mubarak himself in Germany before he went to the hospital, and later by different government representatives. I guess for two reasons. One, Al-Baradei's calculation was to project the image of someone who is interested in significant political reform in Egypt. It's not only about him running. It's about him pushing the country into greater democratization, greater political freedom, and better respect for human rights, better political competition. And this does not go well with the possibility of Dr. Baradei becoming just one candidate of a party. Secondly, which is a good reason, we have seen how party candidates were treated in 2005. Ayman Noor and Nu'man Gomaa. And this is not the most rosy, I guess you would agree, sort of prospect, which you would offer an opposition candidate. I disagree a bit on the emergency law. No, it's the emergency, state of emergency makes it impossible for political parties and political actors to become active. No, you cannot rally, be it they are arrested according to regular laws or based on the emergency law, I do not know it. But the fact of the matter is that if three Egyptians meet in the public space, you can arrest them according to the state of emergency.
Jeremy.
Yeah, just one comment on the stability and instability issue. We haven't really used the word economy or economics, and you know it's true here, it's true in Egypt. It's the economy, stupid, and frankly, Egypt is experiencing something like 4.5% to 5.5% growth this year. The situation is never good, obviously. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of poverty, rising inequality, but it's not bad necessarily either, and. Things really go down the tubes when issues touch on bread and butter issues, touch on people's pocketbooks, and there seems to be a lot of infusion of capital into the economy from the state this year. Don't underestimate the ability of the state sort of to prime the pumps pre-election. In this pre-election period, public sector wages were just increased, and so I think this is something to watch as well, not just the politics of it.
We're almost out of time, but I have one question that was handed to me. There are actually people in the outer room listening from out there, and so I think we'll end on this one. This is from Camille Ice, the Truman National Security Project. What can the United States government, in the current context, do to best demonstrate support for democracy and human rights in the run-up to the 2010 and 2011 elections? So I'll ask each of our speakers to comment on that, and please also you can add any closing thoughts, regarding the general subject of the elections, and then we'll finish. You want to?
Sure.
Want to go first, Jeremy?
Well, the role of the United States, it's obviously been a tremendous debate in this town for some time. Clearly, the United States is doing something right now with the election. There's a technical assistance program to train people. So USAID, other programs are committing resources in that regard. Now, there are people in this room that want to see a lot more done. There are people who want to see rhetoric increased and raised and heightened and sharpened. There are people who want to see our foreign military assistance conditioned on changes in Egyptian behavior on the ground and opening up of space. And there are people in this room that have don't want anything to do with that. And it's become sort of more polarized over time, and the administration is in a very sensitive position. It's trying to sort of straddle that line, and as I mentioned before, straddle that line in the context where Egypt is playing a very positive role and a very helpful role in our regional peace efforts. And again, I'll just reiterate, I don't envy those in that position to have to sort of walk that line.
Okay. To my mind, the U.S. government cannot afford to be silent about Egypt and its events in 2010, 2011. The political calendar, the cycle which we are looking at, is going to force the administration to address different issues. We saw it a couple of weeks ago, right after the April 6th administration. Spokesman of State Department had to address the arrests which took place. We will see more of those scenes and similar scenes to 2005 and 2010, 2011. So the administration, so silence or continuing to treat Egypt and its politics as a Egyptian politics as a low-profile issue is, to my mind, not an option. You will be forced by the political calendar to address it. Secondly, while realizing the significance of what Jeremy has just said, there is a room of maneuver for the U.S. administration to address election-related issues primarily. And to my mind, what needs to be done is, A, to focus on the upcoming parliamentary elections. There is no need to address the presidential elections. It's very tough to tackle the demands by Al-Baradei and his group to amend the Constitution to allow for greater space for independence. From a U.S. perspective, this brings in right away the question of what would happen to the possibility of a Muslim Brotherhood candidate and how to tackle that. So realistically, this is not part of what can be said in 2010. What can be said in 2010 is, A, on the extension of the state of emergency, of the emergency law. Here, a firm position, at least a position of sorts, needs to be conveyed. And this is part of what the president promised. And President Obama says that he is going to address issues which the government of Egypt has put forward as potential future reform steps. Here you have one clear promise which is not being realized. So state of emergency, A. B, supervision of elections. If we no longer have judicial supervision, what about international monitoring? And well beyond, to my mind, Jeremy, beyond training domestic observers. We have, for the first time, an opposition spectrum in Egypt, formal, informal, religious, secular, which has come to agree on the need of international monitoring. So why is the U.S. government silent on that? I understood the position in 2005 because there was a great disagreement in Egypt whether this is part of what we want or not, and question of sovereignty, and the regime played successfully as a game of sovereignty, and sovereignty is being challenged and so on. So today it's not the case. So why not? And finally, why not address once again the structural conditions of political competition in Egypt approaching the parliamentary elections? Restrictions on political parties, restrictions on civil society organizations, on NGOs, restrictions on candidates. So address the structuring conditions of political competition. Doing all three
elements of what I have just said does not mean that the U.S. by any means would be endorsing al-Baradei or his demands or any set of actors in Egypt, and does not have, in that case, to go into a detailed discussion of which personality, who is a preferable actor, opposition or otherwise, to the U.S. To my mind, this needs to be said, and silence, treating the matter as a low priority issue, gets interpreted in Egypt de facto as a support of the Mubarak regime.
Thank you very much, Amr. I think this is just the opening of a conversation we'll be having over the next year and a half or so. I want to thank Jeremy Sharp and Amr Hamzawi for getting us started, a solid start on that conversation, and thank you for participating.